Thanks there to Sam Davis for In Your Company. In 30 minutes, you've Jason with some music, but before that, you've got Double Science in The Science Show.
Welcome to The Science Show on Cambridge 105. Our topic today is the science of growing food crops. What can be done to ensure the farmer's crop succeeds? And what is being done to ensure that our food is safe to eat? We talk with a crop specialist at a world-leading science company here at their offices in Cambridge.
All that and even more after this bit of a tune.
This is The Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. We start with hello from me, Roger Frost.
And hello from me, Daniel Edwards, standing in for Chris Creese for the season. We have 30 minutes of science they never told us about in school, with a special focus on sciencey happenings here in Cambridge.
This week on The Science Show, we have focus on growing food crops. The growing world population puts an increasing demand to farm the land 2, 3, or more times effectively than we used to.
But growing crops is risky, and what farmers want more of is a guarantee that their efforts will bear fruit. At the same time, consumers obviously want a guarantee that their food is free from harmful additives.
Well, some weeks back, I visited an agricultural show looking for people involved in making farming more scientific. It was there, luckily, I met Bayer Crop Science and ultimately got to speak with one of their experts at the base in the Cambridge Science Park. I spoke with Dr. Julian Little, and we talk about a variety of topics for the next 18 minutes or so, and then we'll be back with some science news.
So here we have Bayer Crop Science, been in Cambridge now for quite a long time, and in the UK for nigh on 100 years, actually. Bayer Crop Science is a big German company, and we are the biggest supplier of pesticides or crop protection products in the UK.
In this particular one, are there labs?
Most of our fundamental research is done elsewhere, and in some cases in Europe, in places like Germany or Belgium or the Netherlands. Although we do some research work, and it will tend to be more field-based. So this is where we'll be testing products in the field, on the farm, to make sure that they work in a UK-specific environment. So with proper farmers being able to look at our products and saying, yes, that works in our situation.
So the question I forgot to ask is, what does Bayer do?
Bayer is a pretty big company. It's a rare in the sense of it's a life sciences company. So we do pharmaceuticals. We do over-the-counter products as well. So if you take a Barocca or something like that, it'll be a Bayer product. But we also do agrochemicals, which means pesticides or crop protection products for farmers and growers to grow our food. And then we also do some work on plastics. For example, the World Cup football is made from a Bayer plastic.
So the kinds of scientists here...
Well, we have a number of scientists who either started off as scientists and are doing things other than that, or there are scientists that are either looking at things in a field situation or will be looking at data coming in from all sorts of different places and making sure that that data makes sense, make sure that our products can be used safely and properly, and make recommendations for either the company to go forward or in some cases submitting data to the government so that they can look at that and determine whether our products can be used in the UK. Essentially, for any of our products to be used in the field, you have to get permission to do so, so what they call a regulatory approval. Now, that will involve a number of scientists gathering up data on the safety of our products, but also on things like the environmental impact of our products. Because as you can imagine, if you were to misuse a pesticide or not use it in the proper way, then of course you could do damage in the environment. So we have to demonstrate that if you use these products properly, they will be able to control the pests and diseases that you have to control if you want to make high quality, affordable food, but not in a way that would damage the environment in any way.
Okay, so this is like a doctor giving me a medicine and me taking the wrong dose at the wrong time.
Yes, indeed. Although in some ways for a pesticide, It's not just about the safety of it, which is what it tends to be for a medicine. It's also about what happens to it in the environment. Because if you think about it, you know, your average medicine isn't sprayed over fields or isn't used to treat seeds. An agrochemical has to be even more safe than some medicines because we need to make sure that it doesn't harm the environment as well. What will normally happen is that you will have, within a laboratory situation, you'll have chemists making particular products, so particular chemicals. You'd then have biologists out there who would spray those chemicals on a plant or an insect or a fungus within a greenhouse situation. And then in my case, so I'm a biochemist by trade, you'd actually be testing to see how those chemicals worked and to identify where in the plant, for example, if it was a herbicide or a weed killer, where in that plant does that chemical kill that plant?
Oh.
And that's a really important thing. It, obviously, again, if it were to be hitting something in a plant that's also in a human, then you might think, there might be a problem with the safety of that product. But if it's a very new target site, a new enzyme that nobody's ever seen before or seen as a target site before, then that's really quite exciting. And in my time, we've seen those sort of things happening. Now, when you've got all of that information together, so when you know whether it's active, when you know that it's an interesting chemical, we might send those back to the chemists and say, right, we want lots more chemicals that are like this one. So you might change something subtly around the structure of that chemical, much as you would with a Lego set, if you like, in terms of just making small changes and then seeing, you know, taking that chemical back and spraying it in the greenhouse and checking to see whether it's maybe more active or it has a broader spectrum, so it will kill more things that you need to kill, or it might be better in the environment, or it might be safer. So that's what they call optimizing your products. And then if you get even further, you might take that into a field and do even more work, do a lot more testing in the environment. So it's a very long process, actually, and sometimes can take up to 10 or 12 years.
Wow.
To go right from that first chemical that a biologist sprayed in the greenhouse to being able to sell it in the real world. And pretty much it's quite expensive as well. You're talking £200 or £300 million.
Whoa. I mean, that's analogous to drug development, is it not?
It's very, very similar. So the whole idea of chemists busily working in the chemistry department, producing interesting things, hopefully, for a biologist to be testing or a biochemist to be testing. And then, of course, the bit that takes all the time is the making sure it's safe to people that are using the chemical or people that it might be exposed to them, or, of course, the environment in which it's going to be used.
Okay. So presumably in days past, you'd come up with an idea, pop it in a bag and sell it. But today, that must be very difficult.
It's true to say that in the 1960s, for example, you could get probably, say, 1 in 1,000 chemicals that you tried. You could find a product. These days, it's closer to 1 in 1,000,000. So that'll give you an idea of how much more complicated it is to be able to get something to the market. And I said that it took 10 to 12 years to bring something to the market. Pretty much all of that time is taken up with making sure things are safe and good for the environment. So the discovery bit is a lot easier in terms of time that it will take than it does to make sure that it's safe and desirable.
What about the kind of safety and then this kind of knock-on effects?
When you're testing your product for the first time, what you're looking for is, does it kill the weed that I'm trying to kill? Because you need to kill weeds to be able to grow the food you want to grow. Mm-hmm. Does it kill an insect that will eat the plant? Or can it kill the fungus that will eat that plant or make the quality so low that nobody would want to eat it? So all of these things are called pesticides, and you know, you're not allowed to sell them unless they work. Of course you're not. However, you have to be very careful when you're doing these things, because these things have to go out into the environment. People will eat the food. You have to do huge numbers of tests to make sure that there aren't any unexpected strange things happening. Pretty intense process, takes a lot of scientists' work, but actually it's worth it, because what you end up with is a farmer or a grower being able to control the diseases and the pests and everything else that they need to control, so that when you go to the fridge, you know that the food that you're taking out of that fridge is safe in terms of at least the things that have been used on it. In the case of Bayer Crop Science, we've been celebrating last year our 150th year as Bayer. So this year's 151 years. It's quite important for us that we're still there in the future as well. You know, we've got a big history, and it's really important that we do things right, that we make the right decisions. So yes, of course, there are lots and lots of different regulations, but you won't be at all surprised we go over and above those regulations to make sure that not only are the regulators and the governments around the world that are happy with what we're doing, but that we're happy too.
Okay, so in a sense, you're setting the pace of...
Absolutely. So in the UK, Bayer Crop Science is the largest agrochemical supplier, and we take that responsibility very, very seriously.
Okay, so I will see the brand somewhere stuck on a weed killer.
Indeed, we have what they call the Bayer Garden range of products as well, so that'll be... In some cases, things like Baby Bio as a fertiliser, or even Provado as an insecticide range. These things were originally developed for larger scale use, but we found that they can be used very well and very safely at a garden level as well.
Okay. So curiously, how does one particular weed killer happen to know to kill everything except grass?
When you're trying to control some weeds in your lawn, when you're spraying your lawn with a watering can or whatever, you've got both physical differences between the weeds and the grass, and also a biochemical difference, if you like. And the physical reason is quite simply that the real problem weeds in your lawn are broadleaf weeds, so they tend to be wider leaves and will actually catch the chemical more than these spiky long leaves of the grass, where actually a lot of the chemical just runs off the grass. So that's one of the reasons why you're able to control weeds in your grass. On the biochemical side of things, actually grasses are tougher. They're more resistant to the things that we put on there. They are better able to grow in the presence of chemicals than broadleaf weeds. And that's purely a biochemical reason. They're just more active and more able to break these products down. Okay. Which is fine for your lawn, but actually it's a problem when it comes to the fields, mm-hmm. where grass weeds are a real problem within our crop plants like wheat and barley and oilseed rape and all these things.
Yeah, that's excellent, that's better. It's not just weed killers, is it? What sorts of things are there? What does a farmer use?
Yes. So for a farmer to grow his crop, and if you think about it, what you're trying to do is give your crop a chance to grow. So what you want to do is to kill weeds around that crop, because the weeds will cut down the amount of light that gets to the crop. It'll also steal the water and some of the nutrients in the soil. So you need to control those weeds to allow your crop to flourish. There are also pests, things like little insects that will come down in there. They won't just eat the crop, and that's one problem, but they'll also spread diseases, viral diseases, which are impossible to control in any other way. So frequently a farmer will control an insect, not because he's worried about the insect, but because of what the insect might be spreading. A bit like if you think about it, malaria and mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So you're not really worried about the mosquito itself. What you're really worried about is what are the diseases that the mosquito is carrying. And then there are fungal diseases. So this is where you'd need a fungicide to make sure that your potatoes don't go all mushy before you even pick them up, or your wheat doesn't keel over because it's got a big infection. In the UK, where it's quite warm and quite wet in the spring and into the summer, fungi are real problems, and you do need to be very careful to make sure you can control diseases within your crops.
Something I think defines scientists is that they measure things. So what unit do you look at and say, that's good?
Well, for a biochemist, we were always interested in the lowest amount of something that you can put on a plant to kill it. From a biochemical perspective, I'm always interested in things that kill a plant at nanomolar levels. So things like 10 to the minus 9 molar. If we're talking about in the greenhouse, what I want to see is things that are working at grams per hectare rather than kilograms per hectare. In the 1960s, we used to use things that used maybe 5, maybe 10 kilos a hectare. These days, you can routinely get away with, say, 100 grams a hectare.
One thing I understand that people do is they breed crops to ensure that they do better. The other thing they're doing is trying to select or trying to adjust the genetic makeup of a plant.
In some ways, all breeding is about changing the genetic makeup of your plant.
Okay.
And it's also true, of course, for animals, if you're breeding a dog or if you're breeding a cow or Dolly the sheep or whatever. But breeding is generally about trying to be quite specific about what the genetics are of your organism. So if you're talking about a new variety of carrot, you can do things by traditional breeding, or you can try and do things in a slightly more organized way, or in some cases in a very random way. So for example, so many of our crop varieties today came from some work done at nuclear power stations, where they would literally mutate seed. So they'd take a bag of seed and stick it by the nuclear reactor. It would be irradiated with gamma radiation, and they'd go away and plant those seeds and see if there was something interesting in that seed. Now, if you think about it, that is about as random mutating as you could possibly imagine. So in some cases, in fact, in most cases with those seed, the seed just didn't germinate properly, or the plant wasn't functional. But there were some plants that were better. So they might yield more, or they might be better at dealing with disease. So they would find occasional plants that would give them something. And that's what they call random mutagenesis. You can do it with a chemical, or you can do it with radiation. And bizarrely enough, that's now considered to be quite conventional. And there are other sorts of breeding where you want to bring in totally new genes, but in a very specific way. So, for example, genetic modification or transgenics or however you want to describe it. These are ways where you would go and look for your gene. So for your carrot, you might look for a gene that is resistant to drought. So you'd go away and look for a plant or even an animal if you want to go far enough away that is able to withstand drought. And you'd look for the gene that gives you that drought tolerance. And you'd say, okay, I'll take that gene and put it in the carrot. And let's see whether that carrot is now drought resistant. And if it is, then you could go ahead and do some more work to make sure it's safe and it works fine and everything else. There's nothing else strange about that carrot. And you might then say, okay, I'm now going to commercialize that carrot. Now, that's what they call genetic modification. It's a very specific way of changing that carrot, not like the random way of doing so using mutagenesis. And yet, bizarrely enough, genetic modification is considered to be very different and needs a lot more regulation than that random way of doing things.
Okay. So the conventional way is the way which is generally accepted?
Yes. So conventional breeding is whatever is accepted on the day.
Okay.
So if you say, yes, you're okay to do random breeding or breeding by normal crossing in the greenhouse, in whatever way, that's fine because that's considered to have been done for a long time and that's conventional. Whereas things like genetic modification, even though that's been around now for 20 years, commercial use now, that's still considered to be unconventional.
On my way in, I noticed a display ticking, a clock ticking away, saying population is increasing and the amount of arable land is decreasing.
There are some big problems out there.
Okay.
And the one that I always talk about is how much land there is to feed people.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 1950s, an area the size of Wembley Stadium used to have to feed two people. These days, it has to feed four people. And if we go through to 2050, it's going to have to feed more than six people. So if you can imagine, that's the sort of imperative that we have, that with increasing population, with decreasing amounts of land, with climate change and all these other things, our ability to grow more food on the same area has got to increase. Otherwise, there simply won't be enough food to go around.
But it would seem that if I go into my supermarket, that successful stuff is now organic. So everyone is wanting to buy organic.
It's interesting that you say that, because actually organic food and organic farming has actually been on the decrease over the last few years. For whatever reason, I think it's a combination of organic food tending to be more expensive, of course.
Okay.
But also, I think some of the myths around organic farming have been exploded. Do you know, you can grow food in a conventional way, in a way that's very environmentally friendly. And likewise, you can grow organic food in a bad way. It's not about the label that you give the food. It's about the farmers and growers and their advisors and the scientists behind all of that that will make the difference. So our view is always we provide products for organic farmers as well, but there should be always room for everybody out there, whether you want to eat high quality, affordable food that's grown conventionally or organic.
Okay, so it's up to people. And a final question, I do throw this question at all sorts of people. Here you are, Julian, in this role which has developed over the many, many years, but is there something you did at school which you never thought you'd use?
When I was at school, I got in continual trouble for not studying French. I was always interested in the science subjects and I didn't understand the need for languages. When I moved to France with the company and lived there for nearly 3 years, I did write back to my French teacher and say, okay, you were right.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Julian.
Thanks there to Dr. Julian Little at Bayer Crop Science. As Julian mentioned, Bayer is a major company, established first in Germany 150 years ago, a company with 110,000 employees,
wow.
And they make human and animal pharmaceuticals, healthcare products, agricultural chemicals, biotechnical products, and specialist plastic.
And if you're wanting to learn more and find examples, for example, of the kind of advice that's given to farmers, say, on what to do when with their crops, I recommend a click to their website. You'll find even phone apps to identify pests and weeds and plant diseases. And I was intrigued to find examples of new seeds that farmers could buy and to learn about the kinds of characteristics that a farmer might be looking for in a seed.
The place to look is bayercropscience.co.uk.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
Let's move on to some recent stories in the news. Well, last week we spoke about the science of making food. This week we found out how to grow crops. I think it's about time we dealt with the important bit. Eating. Tourist season is well underway and Cambridge is busier than ever with crowds from Australia, Japan and America, amongst many others, bustling around the colleges, shops and market square. Well, great news for the local economy, mm-hmm. Terrible for the bike racks, but how are restaurants going to do this summer? Researchers from the University of Surrey published a paper in the International Journal for Hospitality Management all about tourists and food consumption.
I wonder what they were finding out. Surely what tourists eat is simply a matter of their personal taste and whether the food is any good or not.
Well, yes, stripped to its most basic form, that is all that's involved. The individual, the food, and the environment. But in order to use that knowledge, researchers needed slightly more punch behind their ideas.
Okay, well, food's pretty key when you're away on holiday. I mean, I went to Denver and I hardly stopped eating burgers, and their burgers could be piled high with anything you could eat.
But do you know that spending on food tends to account for 1/3 of total holiday spending?
Well, of course it makes sense for restaurants to know what to offer us then. So what, Daniel, are the factors involved in tourists making their choice of food?
Well, the researchers at the University of Surrey found 5 key factors. We'll chat about a couple of them. As with a lot of studies in social psychology, socio-demographic factors such as age and class seem to play an important role when tourists are choosing what to eat during their time abroad. Stick to their home cuisine or branch out and try something new?
Well, there's lots of options in the Cambridge town centre.
Well, yeah, and probably for the best, because I'm sure we also attract a wide range of tourists. One research study followed Chinese tourists grouped by class on their holidays to Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
They found that middle-class Chinese tourists sought out local foods to eat whilst they were away, equating exotic foods with culture.
Uh-huh.
Responding to a questionnaire afterwards, they said that eating local food on holiday would enable them to acquire new food knowledge and evaluate the local cuisine.
Well, I've never quite sat and evaluated a meal. I'm usually preoccupied wondering how much to tip in whatever country I happen to be visiting.
That's true. But I have noticed that Brits abroad seem to fit into 2 broad camps.
Okay.
The ones who seek out burgers and fries wherever they go, and those who want to try something a little bit more unusual.
I think Brits must have a bit of a reputation abroad, because all the holiday resorts that are advertised here seem to have these kind of anglicised restaurants on offer.
Well, We're not the only ones. I mean, just take a walk up Bridge Street in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Indian curry houses, Italian pizza pasta restaurants, Chinese takeaways, a tapas bar, French cuisine, sushi restaurants. I mean, there's an element of feeling safe when you go abroad and see something familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But cultural differences seem to dispose us to differing levels of adventure when it comes to trying new food.
Okay, go on then. So which restaurants are going to be serving the most tourists this summer? And in fact, which one should I go to?
According to this paper from the University of Surrey, Japanese, French and Italian tourists in particular have been observed to avoid local food, preferring tastes similar to their home culture. Mm. So we're likely to see many Japanese tourists trying out the Cambridge version of their national food. And the same is true of French and Italian tourists. Of course, this isn't a blanket rule, and maybe just their food is nicer than ours, but it's a strong tendency which can be used by those in the hospitality industry to capitalise in high tourist season.
We ought to add that some cultures display slight preferences for novel foods, and therefore they do spend their time on holidays trying out the local cuisine.
Yes, well, this particular study suggests that American tourists make a point of trying local food. So my advice to Cambridge residents wanting to get a table in a restaurant whilst the tourists are in town is go somewhere that sells burgers, fries and sachets of tomato ketchup. Though, to be honest, I've only seen the tourists eating ice cream anyway, so you might be fine.
Thanks, Daniel.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
Ah, we've another story, haven't we, Daniel?
Yeah, I read the most amazing story this week about a star 4,400 light years away.
Yes, and this is the Transformer Pulsar Star.
Yes, NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope witnessed a really unusual type of binary star system in June 2013. And after just over a year of analysis and theorising, they've released their hypotheses and a summary of what they observed.
Okay, so what they found out is that a binary star system involves two stars orbiting around a kind of central mass. This system, which is named the AY Sextantis, who'd have thought of that, consists of a rapidly spinning millisecond pulsar. A pulsar is a bright radio beaming neutron star, and it has a larger low mass companion star beside it. The stars complete an orbit in just 4.5 hours, and they're so close together that the pulsar, the flashing, will eventually evaporate its companion.
Until June 2013, NASA's telescope observed the binary system with a strong radio beam. NASA's artist renderings of the stars show this as a wide-angled green beam emitting from a tiny bright centre, which is the compacted nucleus of a dead star that's since gone supernova. Then suddenly, the green radio light vanished.
Well, the scientists searched through each of the levels of light and they found that this sudden extinction of the radio light was matched with a massive increase in gamma rays, which are the kind of higher frequency form of light.
Benjamin Stappers, the astrophysicist at the University of Manchester, who's led the research team on this project, explained it with reference to a switch, morphing the system from a lower energy state to a higher energy one.
Ah, but it's not entirely clear how this has happened.
No, well, this is an unprecedented occurrence, and that's why it's so exciting. Over the past year, Stappers and his international research team have developed an explanation for why the radio light disappeared, but they still don't understand what led to it coming back. The theory for the first part of the puzzle centres on the high-energy pulsar's tendency to draw in material from its lower-energy companion. When too much material from the low-mass star floods the accretion disk surrounding the neutron star, the system heats up enough to glow in X-ray wavelengths.
So next, the turbulence in this disk causes the system to heat up even further, and material starts to get caught up in the pulsar's powerful magnetic fields. The radio beacons vanish because jets are expelled with such force from the star's poles that the star emits gamma rays instead.
On NASA's computer-generated visuals, the gamma rays are emitted from the AY Sextantis pulsar as a sharp, narrow purple-white beam. At this stage, the whole system has transformed from a low-mass X-ray binary to a compact gamma-ray binary.
And what's as yet unclear is what causes this pulsar star to release its companion star, allowing the system to return to its standard orbit, once again emitting the familiar radio beacons of a pulsar.
It took NASA a year to analyse the process of creating this previously unseen binary star transformation. So expect to hear more about this on next July, when hopefully the astrophysicists working on this project will be able to give us the second instalment of this exciting process happening millions and millions of miles away from planet Earth. In the meantime, if you think you know the answer, you could send it to us on the back of a postcard or drop us an email.
And that's pretty much all for today's Science Show on Cambridge 105. In a few days' time, you'll find a podcast recording of the show at our website, which is www.cambridge105.fm.
And you can now pick up our podcast on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science. Our next show on Cambridge 105 will be in 4 weeks' time, on Saturday at the old time of 2:30 p.m.
OK, we've got a bit of a break there. And if you want a reminder of that, in other words, when the shows are, follow us on Twitter at 105 Science. And meanwhile, if you have a science event to promote, a question about science you want to share with us, you can email us on the email science@cambridge105.fm.
And that leaves us to say many thanks to all of our guests today. And I'll say goodbye from me, Daniel Edward.
And bye from me, Roger Frost.
Up next is Jason Allen with some tunes.